My name is Bruce Freeman. The title of this CLE is 2019 Criminal Evidence Update. I have a website. I read all the appellate decisions that come out in New York every week from all four departments of the Appellate Division and the Court of Appeals. I choose the decisions that I find instructive and substantive, and I summarize those. And I put the summaries up every week on the website. I've been doing this since 2013 and now have about 10,000 case summaries as a database. And I'm able to go back into that database and pick out the summaries of decisions that relate to a particular legal issue. I've done that here for the criminal evidence decisions. I've gone back to January 2017 and pulled out all of the decision summaries that relate to criminal evidence in some way up until December of 2018. So the written materials that you have include virtually every criminal evidence case that I found substantive that's been released by our courts in that two-year period from January 2017 through December 2018. I've tried to organize them in a rational fashion, and obviously it would be excruciatingly long to try to go through each case. A lot of the cases are explaining black letter law and don't need to be addressed in an update. So I'm going to pick and choose those issues that seem to present something new or something novel that's worth bringing to your attention. We'll start alphabetically. The first section in the written materials is accomplice and accessorial liability. A few cases have been reversed in the last couple of years because the jury instruction requiring corroboration of an accomplice's testimony was not given. If a witness against the defendant is an accomplice, either as a matter of law, which is decided by the judge, or as a matter of fact, decided by the jury must be instructed that the testimony of an accomplice must be corroborated by credible evidence before it can be accepted. The Pettis case on page 5 defines an accomplice as a matter of law as a witness who, quote, could have been or was charged with a crime based upon the same or some of the same facts or conduct upon which the charges against defendant were based. In Pettis, the failure to give the accomplice as a matter of law instruction was found not to be harmless error because the case against the defendant depended upon the accomplice's testimony. In the Douglas case, on pages 5 and 6 in your materials, the court reversed defendant's gang assault conviction in the interest of justice. It determined that the failure to instruct the jury that witnesses were accomplices as a matter of law, requiring corroboration, was reversible error, and it also found that defense counsel's failure to request the instruction was ineffective assistance. When there is conflicting evidence about whether a witness acted as an accomplice, the jury should be instructed to first decide whether the witness was an accomplice and, if so, to decide whether the witness's testimony was corroborated by other evidence. In the Riley case on page 6, there was conflicting evidence whether an eyewitness was an accomplice. The failure to give the accomplice in fact instruction was reversible error because the jury, if it had been instructed properly, may have discounted the eyewitness's testimony. The Riley court explained that the factual issue of whether a particular witness is an accomplice should be submitted to the jury if different inferences may reasonably be drawn from the proof regarding complicity. Similarly, in the Powell case on page 9, the court's failure to give the accomplice in fact instruction was one reason for the reversal of defendant's murder conviction. In that case, a witness testified he was with the defendant, saw the defendant take out a gun and shoot the victim. After the shooting, it was the witness who picked up the gun and fled with the defendant to an apartment. It was the witness's apartment. The murder weapon was found in the garbage compactor room of the building where the witness and the defendant fled. And shortly after the shooting, the defendant and the witness and his girlfriend were taken into custody from that apartment. Those facts raised a question of fact about whether the witness was an accomplice, and the failure to give the witness the accomplice in fact instruction was reversible error. In order to be an accomplice, a defendant must have solicited, requested, commanded, importuned, or intentionally aided the person who committed the crime. That element of accessorial liability is illustrated in the Fonerin case on page 7. There it was the co-defendant, not the defendant, but the co-defendant doused a helpless victim with lighter fluid and lit the victim on fire. The defendant encouraged the co-defendant with words and recorded the victim burning on his cell phone for about a minute before getting water and putting the fire out. The court reversed the defendant's conviction as an accomplice, finding no evidence that he solicited, requested, commanded, importuned, or intentionally aided the co-defendant. So mere presence is not enough, and even an encouraging remark is not enough to create accomplice liability. Whether a defendant can be convicted of a crime committed by another depends on whether the defendant shared the intent of the other person. The Telesford case on pages 8 and 9 illustrates this very well. There, the two defendants, one was Telesford, the other was Celestine, went into a store. Celestine took 3 rings. Telesford got into an argument with the shopkeeper and hit her. If Celestine shared Telesford's intent to hit the shopkeeper, he would have committed robbery. If not, he committed larceny. And if Telesford shared Celestine's intent to steal the rings, he committed robbery. If he didn't share the intent, he committed assault. The court reversed the robbery convictions because the trial judge did not give the jury a supplemental instruction on the shared intent requirement of accessorial liability. In the Crowley case on page 9, there was some credible evidence that defendant intentionally aided the shooter by locating and isolating the shooting victim. But the evidence didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant shared the shooter's intent to kill the victim, as opposed to robbing or assaulting him. His conviction was reversed and the indictment was dismissed. The next topic is actual innocence. It came up in front of the Court of Appeals in the context of a motion to vacate the defendant's conviction. It's the Tiger case on page 12. There, the Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division, held that the defendant who had pled guilty could not move to vacate her conviction on the ground of actual innocence. The defendant was a nurse who had bathed a disabled child. Blisters developed, and the nurse pled guilty to endangering the welfare of a disabled person, acknowledging that the water must have been too hot. In her motion to vacate her conviction, the nurse presented expert evidence that the blisters were caused by an allergic reaction, not hot water. In fact, she had been sued in a civil case, and she won the case, even though she was prohibited from contesting liability. In holding that actual innocence is not available as a ground for vacating a conviction by guilty plea, the Court of Appeals wrote this: permitting a collateral attack on a guilty plea based on a claim of new evidence that contradicts the solemn admission of guilt entered during the course of a judicial proceeding free of constitutional error would have enormous ramifications to the efficacy of our criminal justice system. The legislature has not sanctioned such claims in a 440-10 motion, with the exception of the production of DNA evidence demonstrating the identity of the actual assailant. And even that narrow exception has legislatively imposed procedural limitations. Defendant nonetheless asks us to judicially create this extraordinary path for a defendant who has pleaded guilty and we decline to do so. Where the defendant has been convicted by guilty plea, there is no actual innocence claim cognizable under CPL 440.10(1)(h). There are a couple of appellate division level cases that have allowed a motion to vacate after a trial based on actual innocence. That's the Mosley case on page 12, and the Mosley case mentions a second department case, People versus Hamilton. In both of those cases, although the it was found that actual innocence was a valid ground for a motion to vacate, in both cases, the appellate division found the evidence did not rise to the level required to demonstrate actual innocence. It basically was simply strong enough to raise some doubt about the evidence that resulted in the conviction, but it wasn't freestanding evidence of actual innocence. There was an interesting case from the Fourth Department involving an Alford plea. There, the appellate court allowed the defendant to vacate his Alford plea when it found that that strong evidence of actual guilt was lacking. Now, as you know, an Alford plea is a way for a defendant to plead guilty without admitting to the crime. Here, the defendant and two co-defendants were seen by a security guard heading toward the exit of a store with unpaid merchandise in a cart. They abandoned the merchandise near the exit, got in a car, and led the police on a high-speed chase, resulting in two accidents and injury to a police officer. The Alford plea issue was not preserved, but the court reviewed it in the interest of justice and found that the evidence of intent to commit grand larceny was lacking. As the court put it, inasmuch as the record lacks strong evidence that defendant acted with the intent to commit grand larceny, the record also lacks strong evidence that defendant caused injury to a person in the course of and in furtherance of the commission or attempted commission of that crime, or during the immediate flight from the crime. So an Alford plea in which a defendant pleads guilty without acknowledging guilt can be vacated if the evidence of actual guilt is not strong. Next is the issue of annotations on trial exhibits, which was addressed by the Court of Appeals a couple of times. In Williams, on page 16, the Court of Appeals determined the inaccurate labeling of trial exhibits, they were photographs, in a PowerPoint presentation by the prosecutor during summation did not deprive the defendant of a fair trial. One photo, for example, was annotated with text indicating the photo depicted the defendant, but the witness who testified about the photo could not definitively say it was the defendant. The trial judge recognized the problem, stopped the PowerPoint presentation, and instructed the jury to disregard the slides. In the court's words, if it would be improper to make a particular statement, it would likewise be improper to display it. If counsel is going to superimpose commentary to images on trial exhibits, the annotations must, without question, accurately represent the trial evidence. Moreover, any type of blatant appeal to the jury's emotions or egregious proclamation of a defendant's guilt would plainly be unacceptable. So the prosecutor was wrong in that case, but it wasn't reversed because the trial judge caught the error and remedied it. In the Anderson case on pages 16 and 17, the Court of Appeals held that the use of PowerPoint presentations and summations showing trial exhibits with captions or annotations is allowed as long as the annotations fairly describe the evidence. In the court's words, PowerPoint slides may properly be used in summation where, as here, the added captions or markings are consistent with the trial evidence and the fair inferences to be drawn from that evidence. when the superimposed text is clearly not part of the trial exhibits and thus could not confuse the jury about what is an exhibit and what is an argument or commentary, the added text is not objectionable. Moving on to the next topic, authentication of photographs. In the Price case on page 18, the Court of Appeals dealt with the authentication necessary when the photograph appears on the internet. In the Price case, again it's on page 18, the Court of Appeals determined that a photograph taken from a website allegedly depicting the defendant with a handgun similar to the handgun used in the charged robbery was not adequately authenticated. The conviction was reversed. The evidence tying the defendant to the website wasn't strong enough. There was no showing defendant controlled the website or that others didn't have access to the website. The court explained that, quote, the authentication requirement cannot be satisfied solely by proof that defendant's surname and picture appears on the profile page. Next, the topic is Brady material. In the Lewis case, on pages 20 and 21, the Third Department determined defendant's motion to vacate his conviction was properly denied. He was convicted of a killing which occurred in prison. The Department of Correctional Services had conducted an investigation. Defendant contended inmates had been coerced into testifying against him, and evidence of the coercion should have been turned over to the defense by the prosecutor. The Third Department found defendant had not demonstrated that the Department of Correctional Services was acting as an agent of the police, and therefore knowledge of the department's investigation could not be imputed to the people, and there was no obligation to turn over that evidence. I'm skipping down now to the topic confessions. The Court of Appeals tangentially dealt with a case out of the First Department. This is Lewis P. on page 29. There, the First Department affirmed the juvenile delinquent adjudication, finding that the appellant committed offenses which, if he were an adult, would constitute criminal sexual act, sexual abuse, sexual misconduct, and endangering the welfare of a child. It was alleged that the appellant, who was 13, put his penis in the anus and mouth of LF, who was 9. The majority concluded the fact that the appellant's mother left the room during the police interrogation at appellant's request, and the investigators having the appellant write a letter of apology to the victim during the interrogation did not render the appellant's confession involuntary. The majority further held that the statements in the medical records made by LF, that's the victim, during a physical exam were relevant to treatment and therefore admissible to corroborate the confession. In the words of the court, to be sure, the presence of a parent is important, as a parent may help a child understand Miranda warnings, so that the child can consciously and voluntarily choose whether to waive or to exercise his constitutional rights to remain silent, to have an attorney present at his questioning, and to have an attorney provided for him without charge if he is indigent. A parent present at questioning also is able to monitor the interrogation, lest the police engage in coercive tactics. However, a child does not have an absolute right to the presence of a parent during interrogation, and it does not follow as a matter of law that a child's confession obtained in the absence of a parent is not voluntary. The Court of Appeals determined that the Lewis P. case from the First Department presented a mixed question of law and fact, which it couldn't review, but two dissenting judges argued juveniles should not be interrogated outside the presence of their adult guardians. But the First Department's ruling stands. In the Hall case on page 30, The court held that the interrogating detective's videotaped statements that preceded the defendant's confession should have been heard by the jury because they were relevant to her state of mind and the voluntariness of her videotaped confession. The detective's statements tended to show the defendant confessed to the possession of drugs to protect her son. The statements by the detective concerned her son's gang membership, extensive criminal behavior, and suspected involvement in the shooting that took place the night before. Defendant wanted to put this evidence before the jury to establish her state of mind upon hearing that information. Further, the substance of the pre-Miranda portion of the interrogation was relevant and material to the state of mind purposes for which defendant sought to offer it. It's beyond cavil that the circumstances surrounding the making of a confession, including the manner in which it was extracted, are relevant to the question of its voluntariness. Thus, the statements and the representations made by the detective during the pre-Miranda portion of the interrogation and the environment in which they were uttered had a bearing on whether defendant's inculpatory statements were the product of a free and unconstrained state of mind. Under defendant's theory of the case, the statements made by the detective during the pre-Miranda portion of the recording not only went to the voluntariness of her confession, but also established why she confessed falsely. Accordingly, county court's evidentiary rulings here excluded evidence directly relevant to a central issue in this case, defendant's state of mind at the time she confessed to possessing the drugs. In Vasquez, on pages 30 and 31, the second department, reversing the child pornography convictions and dismissing the indictment, determined the defendant's waiver of a pretrial Huntley hearing did not waive his right to challenge the voluntariness of the statement at trial. The defendant, who spoke Spanish, gave a written statement in English acknowledging he had downloaded child pornography. However, it was revealed at trial that the police provided information that was in the statement and made changes to the statement without defendant's permission. The defendant had waived a pretrial Huntley hearing on voluntariness, informing the judge he intended to challenge the voluntariness of the statement at trial. The judge, in his bench trial, erroneously ruled defendant had waived his right to challenge the statement. The defendant testified that he did not download the child pornography and that he gave the statement to protect a family member. A family member testified and admitted unintentionally downloading the files. Defendant produced evidence he was at work when at least two of the files were downloaded. As explained on pages 31 and 32 in the materials, effective April 1, 2018, custodial interrogations concerning certain delineated felonies, non-drug A1 felonies, certain felony sex offenses and homicide must be recorded. Statements made in those interrogations which are not recorded are still admissible, but the jury can consider the failure to record in determining whether the statements were made and whether they were voluntary. Skipping down to the next topic, constructive possession. In Miracle, on page 35, the court held that defendant's presence in a meth lab did not demonstrate constructive possession of the contraband. The court explained the evidence demonstrated that defendant and two co-defendants had been in the garage for approximately 1 hour when the officer arrived. There was no evidence that defendant lived in the house or the garage, kept any of his personal belongings there, or had keys to the property. When the officer observed defendant in the workshop area, he was sitting on a stool in front of a bench, not touching anything. No contraband was recovered from the defendant himself, nor was there proof he owned or had even touched any of the contraband. In Gaston, on page 37, the court reversed because the circumstantial evidence instruction wasn't given. There was direct evidence defendant had dominion and control over the apartment, but the evidence of dominion and control over the drugs was circumstantial. In Yerion, on page 36, The third department reversed defendant's conviction, finding that her mere presence in the meth lab did not demonstrate dominion and control over the lab. The court explained, quote, knowledge of the presence of an illegal substance does not, without more, meet the people's burden to demonstrate that a defendant had the ability and intent to exercise dominion and control over the contraband. Next topic, cross-racial jury instructions. In Boone, on pages 40 and 41, the Court of Appeals explained that where identification of the defendant is an issue, and the identifying witness and the defendant appear to be of different races, upon request, the court must give the cross-racial identification jury instruction, even if the issue didn't come up at trial. The instruction should state, one, that the jury should consider whether there is a difference in race between the defendant and the witness who identified the defendant, and two, if so, the jury should consider that some people have greater difficulty in accurately identifying members of a different race than in accurately identifying members of their own race, and whether the difference in race affected the accuracy of the witness's identification. In Croyador, on pages 41 and 42, the First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that Boone applies retroactively to cases on direct appeal. Expert evidence on cross-racial identification should have been allowed in that case, and the request for the cross-racial jury instruction should have been granted. The First Department wrote, quote, the court should have permitted defendant to introduce expert testimony to the effect that witnesses are less likely to accurately identify persons of other racial groups than persons of their own race. The case turned on the accuracy of the victim's cross-racial identification of defendant, and there was no corroborating evidence connecting defendant to the crime. Furthermore, the circumstances surrounding the identification did not render it so reliable as to justify precluding expert testimony. The expert testimony produced during the Frey hearing sufficiently established that the cross-race effect has been generally accepted in the relevant scientific community. The people do not dispute that this phenomenon applies to identifications of certain racial groups. Moreover, it can be deducted from the expert testimony that the cross-race effect applies to all racial groups. The next topic is a very active topic in the appellate sphere, the DeBoer street stop and traffic stop criteria. In Gates, on page 43, the Fourth Department ruled that the big bags of illegal cigarettes inside the passenger compartment of defendant's car should have been suppressed because the trooper didn't have a founded suspicion of criminality when he asked what was in the bags, a level 2 inquiry under DeBoer. As the Court of Appeals has described the DeBoer criteria, quote, where a police officer seeks simply to request information from an individual, that level 1 request must be supported by an objective, credible reason, not necessarily indicative of criminality. A level 2 encounter, also known as the common law right of inquiry, requires a founded suspicion that criminal activity is afoot and permits a somewhat greater intrusion than level 1. At level 3, a police officer is authorized to forcibly stop and detain an individual where the officer has reasonable suspicion that the particular individual was involved in a felony or a misdemeanor. An arrest is authorized at the fourth and final level where the officer has probable cause to believe that a person has committed a crime. The Court of Appeals affirmed the Fourth Department's ruling in Gates, that's on pages 41 and 42, but Judge Garcia wrote an extensive dissent, arguing that the four-level DeBoer criteria, at least for traffic stops, is no longer viable. That's on pages 42 through 45. The last sentence in Judge Garcia's dissent reads, whether or not it is time to reevaluate the vitality of DeBoer, I disagree with the conclusion that a trooper who approaches a vehicle with a sagging trunk, alone and at night, and finds three male passengers behaving nervously, cannot ask the driver about the contents of a number of large, unusually shaped bags piled on the floor and in the back seat. In White, on page 49, the police officer did not have a founded suspicion of criminality when he asked the defendant, a passenger in the car, "What do you have?" And defendant told the officer he had a weapon. According to the officer, the defendant was acting nervous, shaking his knees and legs up and down, and leaning forward in his seat with his hands in his lap and his arms tightly at his side. The court held that the weapon should have been suppressed. In Furs, on page 51, the defendant got out of a slow-moving car, holding his waistband, and ran when the police told him to stop. In order to justify pursuit, the police must have reasonable suspicion that a crime has been or is about to be committed. The court held that the pursuit was not justified because there was no testimony the defendant was seen in possession of a weapon or that defendant's conduct indicated he possessed a weapon. In Simmons, on page 51, the defendant walked by a police officer holding his waistband. The officer asked him to show his hands, and a gun was revealed. The court determined the officer had a founded suspicion of criminal activity when he asked to see the defendant's hands. Noting the high crime area, the officer's experience with weapons possession crimes in the area, and the defendant's grabbing his waistband with his hand under his shirt. In Walker, on page 52, the defendant's refusal to turn around upon request and his hands at his waistband justified the officer's drawing his weapon for the officer's safety and pursuit when the defendant ran. The court noted that officers are trained that people keep their weapons tucked inside their waistbands right where a defendant was reaching. Flight, in combination with the other circumstances, created reasonable suspicion justifying a forcible stop. In Noble, on page 55, the suppression court used the wrong DeBoer criteria. The defendant was sleeping in his car when the officer tapped on the window to wake him up. The defendant then tried to put the car in gear, and the officer opened the door and turned off the ignition. The officer's action constituted a forcible stop, requiring reasonable suspicion of a crime, or that a crime has been committed, is being committed, or is about to be committed. The motion court applied the lower founded suspicion criteria. The appellate court granted the suppression motion. In Newson, on pages 55 and 56, the police officer stopped the defendant's car for a traffic violation and asked him whether he had anything illegal in the car. The question required a founded suspicion of criminality, which the officer did not have at the time the question was asked. The fruits of the robbery found in the car should have been suppressed. In Jones, on pages 56 and 57, the court found that the officer's knowledge of past criminal and gang activity in the area, coupled with the defendant's actions, justified a level 2 inquiry, which rose to a level 3 when the defendant fled. As the court explained, in determining whether a pursuit was justified by reasonable suspicion, the emphasis should not be narrowly focused on any single factor, but rather should be based on an evaluation of the totality of the circumstances, which takes into account the realities of everyday life unfolding before a trained officer. We also note that, although flight alone is insufficient to justify pursuit, defendant's flight in response to an approach by the police, combined with other specific circumstances indicating that the suspect may be engaged in criminal activity, may give rise to reasonable suspicion, the necessary predicate for police pursuit. In Rose, on page 57, the officer was driving around the area where a stolen car had been found and saw the defendant walking. When the officer activated his lights and got out of the car, the defendant ran and the officer pursued him. The court held that the officer did not have a founded suspicion of criminality when he first attempted to approach the defendant, and there were no other circumstances which provided the officer with reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. The pursuit was not justified. In Sullivan, on page 59, the court held that the search of defendant's pockets was not justified. The defendant was sitting in a parked car with an expired inspection sticker. The officer approached the car, saw a kitchen knife on the floor of the car, and asked the defendant to get out of the car. The defendant was immediately frisked, and a small amount of marijuana was seized from his pocket. The frisk was not justified for safety reasons, and even if the frisk were justified, the officer had no reason to reach into defendant's pocket because there was no reason to suspect defendant had a weapon in his pocket. In Parker, on pages 59 and 60, the Court of Appeals noted that the validity of the street stops presented a mixed question of law and fact, which can be reviewed by the Court of Appeals only to the extent of determining whether there is support in the record for the court's ruling. The police had received a report of a robbery at the location. The defendants were the only persons seen when the police arrived, and both ran or walked away when asked to stop. The court concluded that the record supported the ruling upholding the propriety of the stops and searches. In Geddes Kelly, on page 61, the Second Department held that the search of defendant's pockets was justified as a search incident to arrest after a traffic stop, but the search of defendant's wallet was unlawful, and the seized credit cards should have been suppressed. In King, on pages 59 and 60, the Second Department held that the situation escalated when, after a justified approach by the officer, defendant thrust his hand in his pocket and refused to remove it. The officer was then justified in drawing his weapon and placing it across his chest. Pursuit was justified when the defendant ran. The motion to suppress the abandoned handgun and statements was properly denied. In Bailey, on pages 62 and 63, the Second Department held the motion to suppress the seized weapon, identification, and statements should have been granted. The police stopped the defendant's car and approached with guns drawn on the basis of an anonymous phone call, which described a man with a gun and described the car the man was driving, including the license plate number. The anonymous call did not provide the officers with reasonable suspicion sufficient to justify stopping and frisking a suspect. In Jones, on page 63, the Second Department held that the motion to suppress the firearm and statement should have been granted. The court explained, this encounter began as a level 2 intrusion, with the officer, while seated in the vehicle, stating police and asking defendant to stop, then exiting his vehicle, walking onto the sidewalk, and again stating police and asking the defendant to stop. Thereafter, the officer's pursuit of the defendant, by getting closer to the defendant, picking up with his pace, constituted a level 3 intrusion under DeBoer, requiring a reasonable suspicion that the defendant was involved in a felony or a misdemeanor. That the defendant had a nondescript bulge in his right jacket pocket, was leaning to the right side, and walked away from the officer without complying with the officer's requests for him to stop, did not support a reasonable suspicion of particularized criminal action. A bulging jacket pocket is not indicative of criminality. A pocket bulge, unlike a waistband bulge, could be caused by any number of innocuous objects, and an individual has a right to be let alone and refuse to respond to police inquiry. Since this level 3 intrusion was not justified, it cannot be validated by the officer's subsequent observation of the firearm. And finally, in Brown, on page 64, the First Department determined the seized items and the identification of the defendant were properly suppressed. The police made a gunpoint arrest of the defendants based upon an anonymous tip that an unspecified apartment on the sixth floor had been burglarized. The defendants were seen leaving an apartment on the sixth floor carrying bags. That information didn't provide reasonable suspicion to support an immediate forcible seizure without any inquiry. The next topic is DNA. In Robinson, on page 69, the court held that there is no time limit on a motion pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 440.30 for forensic DNA testing, and the motion is not barred by failure to seek that relief in prior motions to vacate a conviction. The court granted the motion for some of the evidence and noted the people's conclusory assertion that the evidence no longer exists was legally insufficient and did not demonstrate the evidence was not available for testing. In Gonzales, on pages 76 and 77, the court held that the motion for a Frey hearing was properly denied based upon an 8-month hearing held in a court of coordinate jurisdiction, which found that low copy number, that's LCN, DNA testing was generally accepted as reliable and was not a novel scientific procedure. In James, on page 70, the court held that even though the defendant's DNA was found on the handle of the door of the car in which the victim was sitting when he was robbed, the jury should have been given the circumstantial evidence instruction. Although the DNA was strong evidence of the defendant's presence at the scene of the crime, mere presence is not direct evidence of the commission of the crime. In Augustus, on page 73, the Second Department held that the detective's affidavit seeking a warrant for a DNA swab was insufficient, and the motion to dismiss should have been granted. As the court explained, the affidavit of the detective submitted in support of the search warrant application was conclusory and insufficient to establish probable cause to issue the warrant. The detective stated that he believed evidence related to the victim's murder may be found in the defendant's saliva based upon his interview of witnesses, information supplied to him by fellow police officers, and his review of police department records. However, the detective did not identify the witnesses or indicate what information he obtained from them, and did not specify what police department records he reviewed or what information was contained in those records. In Herskovic, on page 75, the Second Department reversed defendant's gang assault conviction in part because of the weakness of the high sensitivity DNA analysis. The court wrote, "The analysis found that it was 133 times more likely that the DNA sample originated from the defendant and the complainant than from the complainant and an unknown, unrelated person. The analysis of the DNA was based upon a Caucasian population and failed to take into account the genetic history of the defendant, a member of the Hasidic population. Moreover, the likelihood ratio was only 133, a relatively insubstantial number." In Powell, on page 75, the Second Department determined that the prosecutor's overstatement of the value of the DNA evidence and reference to facts not in evidence, what the defendant said to her, deprived defendant of a fair trial. The statements by the prosecutor improperly encouraged inferences of guilt based on facts not in evidence, improperly injected her own credibility into the trial, and improperly vouched for the credibility of a witness for the people. In light of the powerful influence of DNA evidence on juries, the opportunity for juror confusion regarding the limited probative value of the DNA methodology employed in this case and the qualified nature of the test results, the prosecutor engaged in misconduct when she misrepresented and overstated the probative value of the DNA evidence by telling the jury that the defendant's DNA was on the safety of the murder weapon. As a result, the defendant was deprived of his right to a fair trial. Turning to the next topic, Frey hearings. In Fields, on page 76, the court held that a Frey hearing in another trial could be relied upon to demonstrate the computer program which purported to identify an individual's DNA in a mixture was not novel and was generally accepted by the scientific community, even though the prior case was on appeal. In Gonzales, on pages 76 and 77, the court held that the motion for a Frey hearing was properly denied based upon an 8-month hearing held in a court of coordinate jurisdiction, which found that low copy number, that's LCN DNA testing, was generally accepted as reliable and was not a novel scientific procedure. In Wilson, on page 77, The Third Department held that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to request a FRI hearing concerning the true allele casework system for interpreting mixed DNA samples. The case, the appeal, was held in abeyance and remitted to hold the hearing. The court wrote, at the time of defendant's pretrial proceedings in 2014, there were no reported trial court or appellate court decisions in this state establishing the reliability of the true allele casework system had been assessed through a FRI hearing, or that any court in the state had otherwise accepted expert testimony regarding that proprietary computer program. Given these circumstances, we do not find that it would have been futile for defense counsel to have requested a FRI hearing to challenge the reliability of the true allele casework system, or that such an application would have had little or no likelihood of success. The first code word to put on your form is reversal. Again, the first code word for the first hour of this criminal evidence CLE is reversal. The next topic is identification. In Clay on page 82, the court held that a single photo identification made by a police officer who was present at the street encounter from which the defendant fled was not admissible because no notice of the identification was provided to the defense. The trial court had held the identification was merely confirmatory and no notice was required. The court noted that police identification is not exempt from statutory notice and hearing requirements. In Everett on page 83, the court allowed a police officer to testify about the victim's identification of the defendant because the victim's statement was an excited utterance. The victim said, "Oh my God, it's the same guy. Thank God you caught him." In Gambale on page 85, the identification was found to be unduly suggestive. The ID was made by the defendant's parole officer after the parole officer was told the person in the video to be shown to the parole officer was the defendant. In Reeves on page 85, the court held that the failure to place the photograph used by the police to identify the defendant in evidence and the failure to explain the search process which resulted in locating the photograph rendered the identification unreliable. The dissent noted that this is the first case where an identification which was not shown to be unduly suggestive was not admissible. In Cole on page 86, the Third Department held that the people should have notified the defendant that the victim of a burglary had identified him on the police department's Facebook page. The error was deemed harmless. The victim, Phoebus, had been burglarized and went to the police department to identify the stolen goods which the police had recovered from the defendant. The police told her the name of the defendant and said his photo was on the department's Facebook page. The court wrote, "We are not presented with the issue of whether maintenance by a police department of a Facebook page or a website with mugshot photos of arrested individuals or referral of individuals to such a website are, without more, police-initiated identification procedures because, in this case, the police officer also provided Phoebus with defendant's name when he told her that she could view a picture of the person who had been arrested for burglarizing her home on the police department's Facebook page. The fact that she had been provided with defendant's name could have influenced her identification of defendant when she subsequently viewed the Facebook page. This, in our view, was sufficient police involvement to invoke the notice requirement of CPL 710.30. Inasmuch as notice was not provided, county court erred in permitting Phoebus to identify defendant as the person who came to her home prior to the burglary. But again, the error was deemed harmless in that case. In Reddick, on page 87, the Second Department determined it was error to allow a detective to testify that the person depicted in a video was the defendant. The error was deemed harmless The court wrote, there was no basis for concluding that the police detective was more likely than the jury to correctly determine whether the defendant was depicted in the video. The detective had arrested the defendant more than 2 weeks after the crime, and at that time briefly interviewed the defendant. There was no evidence that the defendant had changed his appearance prior to trial, and the record is devoid of any other circumstances suggesting that the jury, which had ample opportunity to view the defendant, would be any less able than the detective to determine whether the defendant was in fact the individual depicted in the video. In Ramirez, on page 87, the Second Department held that the detective's testimony that the complainant picked the defendant out of a lineup was inadmissible bolstering. The court reversed the conviction in the interest of justice. The court wrote, a violation of the rule against bolstering may not be overlooked except where the evidence of identity is so strong that there's no serious issue upon that point. Here, the evidence that the defendant committed the crime was not so overwhelming as to render the error harmless. The error was compounded by improper comments made during the people's summation regarding the complainant's identification of the defendant as the robber. In Vaux, on page 90, the Fourth Department reversed the defendant's conviction in part because the prompt outcry testimony included the identity of the assailant. The court wrote, the court erred in permitting the people to present prompt outcry testimony that exceeded the proper scope of such testimony. Although evidence that a victim of sexual assault promptly complained about the incident is admissible to corroborate the allegation that an assault took place, such evidence is limited to only the fact of the complaint, not its accompanying details, including the identity of the assailant. We thus conclude that the court erred in permitting two of the three prompt outcry witnesses to testify concerning the identity of the alleged assailant. And again, the conviction was reversed there. In Holmes, on page 90, the Second Department held that the detective's testimony that defendant was identified in a lineup was inadmissible bolstering. Even though this was a one-witness identification case, the Fourth Department found the error harmless because the evidence of guilt was deemed overwhelming. On July 1, 2017, the Criminal Procedure Law, sections 60.25 and 60.30, were amended to allow, in some circumstances, testimony about a witness's prior identification of the defendant from a photo array if the blind or blinded procedure is used. That's where the person presenting the array doesn't know which photo depicts the subject. Identical statutory changes were made at the same time to Family Court Act sections 343.3 and 343.4. So in some circumstances now, where the blind or blinded procedure is used, the witness identifying the defendant at trial may testify about identifying the defendant in that pictorial procedure. And it's possible for a detective who administered the procedure and witnessed the identification from the photographs can also testify about that pictorial identification. When the blind or blinded procedure is used, that testimony is no longer considered improper bolstering. Turning to the next topic, the justification defense. On page 98, the Marchand case, the court reversed the defendant's conviction as against the weight of the evidence, finding that the people did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's act was not justified. Although the defendant had a knife, the victim was not deterred and pursued and attacked her. Here's how the court explained it. Defendant's statements at the scene and in her police interview evinced a belief that deadly force was necessary to protect her from decedent, and we conclude that the people did not demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that her belief was objectively unreasonable. Instead, The credible evidence established that decedent was in a drunken rage during a heated argument with defendant, that he threatened trouble if the police came, that he had repeatedly forced open doors in the course of pursuing defendant throughout the apartment, that he was not deterred even when she armed herself with a knife, that he had cornered her in the bathroom and pulled her hair, and that he had grabbed her by the hair to prevent her from leaving the bathroom just before she stabbed him. In the Braithwaite case on pages 98 and 99, the court held that the failure to instruct the jury that if they find the defendant not guilty of the highest count based on the justification defense, they cannot consider any of the lesser counts. The same issue has recurred in several other cases in the last couple of years. For example, Santiago on page 98, Breckinridge on page 101, and Fletcher on pages 101 and 102. In Hernandez on page 101, the Third Department reversed defendant's assault conviction, finding that the people did not disprove the justification defense beyond a reasonable doubt in this bench trial. In the court's words, county court stated that it rejected defendant's justification defense because it found that defense to be inconsistent with the multiple wounds on the victim's face, neck, and body. However, independently assessing all of the proof and considering the correctness of the court's factual determinations in the role of a second fact finder, as we must, we do not agree that these injuries are inconsistent with defendant's assertion that he had to swing the knife repeatedly to defend himself as the victim continued to attack and punch him. More significantly, the severity of the victim's injuries does not provide the missing proof that defendant could have retreated with complete safety before he used deadly physical force or even during the knife fight, when he and the victim both testified that the victim continued to throw punches. It was the people's burden to prove, to the same degree as any element of the crime charged, that defendant's actions were not justified. Skipping down now to the section on Miranda. In the Martin case on page 124, the court determined that defendant's statement that he lived in the apartment, which was searched and where contraband was found, did not require Miranda warnings or a 71030 notice. In the words of the court, the detective's routine administrative questioning was not designed to elicit an incriminating response, even if the answer was reasonably likely to be incriminating. In the Blacks case on page 126, the court determined defendant's statement providing the searching parole officers with the combination to a safe and the guns found in the safe should have been suppressed. The search of defendant's girlfriend's apartment was concluded after defendant, who was present in the apartment, violated parole. Defendant was handcuffed and in his underwear when the officer asked for the combination. The officers had already found other weapons and counterfeit DVDs in the apartment. The people unsuccessfully argued the request for the combination was not designed to elicit an incriminating response. In the Wisdom case on pages 128 and 129, the Second Department held that the resumption of questioning in the morning did not require a reiteration of the Miranda warnings. As the court explained, since the defendant in this case had not unequivocally and unqualifiedly invoked her right to remain silent and remained in continuous custody in the interim, police and prosecutors were free to resume their questioning of the defendant within a reasonable time, and to do so without repeating the Miranda warnings. The further questioning at issue here was within a reasonable time under this court's precedent, and that was from the Second Department. Next, we'll look at a couple of cases construing the Molyneux rules. in Leonard on page 131. The Court of Appeals determined evidence of an alleged prior sexual assault identical to the charged offense should not have been admitted to show intent or motive, or as background evidence. In the words of the court, the introduction of the prior alleged assault was not necessary to clarify their relationship or to establish a narrative of the relevant events. Further, the evidence of the uncharged crime was not admissible to show intent. The intent here, sexual gratification, can be inferred from the act. To the extent the evidence was admissible to show defendant's motive in getting the victim drunk, the evidence was highly prejudicial, as it showed that defendant had allegedly engaged in the exact same behavior on a prior occasion with the same victim, classic propensity evidence. The prejudicial nature of the Molyneux evidence far outweighed any probative value that may be attributed to it. In the Frumuasa case, on page 132, the Court of Appeals determined that a contempt order in a civil proceeding involving the same funds defendant was accused of stealing in the criminal action, one, was not Molyneux evidence because it involved the same subject matter as did the criminal action, and two, the probative value of the order on the question of intent outweighed its prejudicial effect. In the court's words, whereas here, the evidence at issue is relevant to the very same crime for which the defendant is on trial, there is no danger that the jury will draw an improper inference of propensity because no separate crime or bad act committed by the defendant has been placed before the jury. In the Bittroff case, on pages 134 and 135, the Second Department held that evidence of prior domestic abuse was admissible in this criminal contempt prosecution. In the words of the court determined that evidence of the defendant's prior acts of abuse against the complainant were admissible as relevant background material regarding the defendant's relationship with the complainant to explain the issuance of a temporary order of protection and as evidence of the defendant's motive and intent in the commission of the charged crimes. In the Wisdom case on page 135, the Second Department in this murder case held that evidence of a prior uncharged crime involving the theft and use of the victim's property was properly admitted because it completed the narrative and provided evidence of the date of the victim's death. In Montgomery on page 137, we have an example of an interesting twist on the Molyneux doctrine. It's been called reverse Molyneux. In Montgomery, the court determined defendants should have been allowed to present reverse Molyneux evidence. And in this case, that was evidence that the defendant did not commit other robberies, which were committed close in time to the charge robberies and which had a similar modus operandi. Defense counsel sought to introduce evidence that three witnesses from uncharged robberies had viewed lineups in which defendant participated but had not identified him as the man who robbed them. In the words of the court, given defendant's right to use reverse Molyneux evidence, defense counsel sought to introduce two categories of evidence. First, counsel wanted to introduce the surveillance videos from the three robberies for which defendant was not on trial to show that he was not depicted in them. The jury was entitled to make its own assessment that the person sitting before them in the courtroom did not match the person shown in the three videos. There was no evidentiary rule that would have excluded the surveillance videos. Second, defense counsel sought to introduce evidence that three witnesses from uncharged robberies had viewed lineups in which defendant participated, but had not identified him as the man who had robbed them. Had defense counsel presented the failure to identify testimony directly through each eyewitness, no evidentiary bar could have been raised. Each eyewitness would have been qualified to say that he or she had viewed defendant in a lineup and that defendant was not the man who had robbed him or her. Had defense counsel been unable to find each of the eyewitnesses, or been otherwise unavailable to testify, and had instead sought only to introduce one or more of the failures to identify through the detective who had supervised the lineup, the detective's testimony would have been hearsay. Counsel could have overcome the hearsay objection by showing that the identifications were admissible on constitutional grounds because they were reliable. Next, under the topic motive to lie, in Vaux on page 138, the Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that defendant was deprived of a fair trial in part because defendant was precluded from presenting evidence of a witness's motive to lie. In the words of the court, it is well settled that in presenting the defense, counsel for the defendant may establish during both cross-examination and on defendant's direct case the complainant's motive to lie. This is not a collateral inquiry, but is directly probative on the issue of credibility. The excluded evidence was not speculative or cumulative, as it went directly to the credibility of the complainant, and the defense counsel offered a good faith basis for the excluded line of questioning and evidence. Next, there are a couple of cases that have come out in the last couple of years dealing with the Peyton issue. In Garvin, on page 140, the Court of Appeals left unchanged the rule that a warrantless arrest may be effected at the threshold of an apartment entrance door without violating Peyton versus New York. That's a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1980. Here, the defendant answered the door when the police knocked. As defendant stood in the doorway, the arresting officer told him he was under arrest. The defendant then turned around with his hands behind his back and was handcuffed. In Caputo, on pages 140 and 141, the court determined defendant's motion to suppress his statements based upon his warrantless arrest in the garage of his home was properly denied. Defendant had failed to stop, led the arresting officer on a high-speed chase, and hid in the rafters of his garage. The court wrote, "The people established that the detective's entry was justified by the doctrine of hot pursuit." The next topic, police misconduct. In Hargrove, on pages 141 and 142, the court determined defendant's motion to vacate his conviction for a 1991 murder was properly granted, requiring a new trial. The early 90s trial lasted one day. One of the police investigators has since been implicated in facilitating false identification testimony. The finger and palm print evidence did not match the defendant or his co-defendant. The blood evidence didn't match. Crucial blood evidence was never tested and may have been lost. The identification evidence, the only evidence upon which the conviction could be based, was problematic. In Holmes, on pages 145 and 146, the First Department reversed defendant's conviction in part because the jury should have been given the adverse inference instruction concerning lost surveillance photos. In the words of the court should have granted defendant's request for an adverse inference charge as to surveillance photos taken in the victim's livery cab after other photos introduced at trial were taken. The photos in evidence showed defendant in the back seat before he left and allegedly returned to rob the driver. The police department collected the photos but destroyed all but a few of them, which were introduced at trial through a detective who alleged that other members of his team selected them as the most relevant. Defendant established that the missing photos were reasonably likely to be material, since they might have shown what type of weapon or object was used by the perpetrator. The record fails to support the people's assertion that the camera could not have recorded the incident.